Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Inside Games Cast for April. It's April, and we're sick. We're sick of paying for shit, man.
Sick of microtransactions, Lawrence. I don't want to see anybody spend any money on microtransactions ever again.
Sorry, we're talking about microtransactions, to a lesser extent DLC. I think to a greater extent early access windows. I think this is the is the thing we actually have a chance to push back against, but we'll get into it. So I'm trying to think of where to start here because it is such a broad topic. I was putting together some notes because a lot of people got upset about the microtransactions in Dragon's Dogma 2. People don't get upset for no reason, you know? Even if that particular issue was overblown, the fact that it found fertile kindling and kind of became a miniature thing really speaks to, I think, people's frustration about the way games are priced. And that's certainly quite understandable, especially when, goddamn it, everything's going up in price. I just saw a graph showing that like fast food prices have gone up over inflation, sometimes by double.
Absolutely, they have,
Everyone's trying to nickel and dime you, and you just want to buy a video game. And even that's a complicated proposition where they're trying to work all the goddamn angles and get more money out of your wallet. And yes, capitalism. Anyway, so I just started putting together some loose notes about recent headlines and microtransactions and how games were getting monetized. And it turns out that the way that games make money is pretty fundamental to the entire industry.
No shit, right?
The scope started just ballooning and ballooning. And now we have, I think, a variety of kind of topical concerns about not only microtransactions, but kind of the spiraling issues from there about the way games are monetized. And specifically, Bruce, you're a very kind of active guy. You kind of have a call to action for people that want to affect the difference, right?
Yeah. That's to me, like, that's what I've seen so many comments is always like, well, I see whining comments on YouTube. And again, I don't mean this as like I'm offended or whatever. It's more just like I see you complaining about it, but I know I'm thinking in my heart of hearts, complaining on a YouTube video is not going to change a thing. The subreddit, maybe, probably not, but maybe. And we're going to get into, number one, what makes money on video games and why it makes money. And then we're going to get into what you can do to actually affect change when it comes to no more microtransactions, no more DLC, no more early access windows, all that stuff. Because I've thought through this a lot, and I'm sure there are other ways. We don't have every way, but I've thought through this because I do want people to affect change when they don't like something. I'm all for affecting a change like this and making things cheaper, better, whatever.
Damn, I admire that. I'm much more fatalistic, I have to admit.
Tell them why, Lawrence.
Well, because the numbers are
that's right.
They
that's
crush right. you. They crush the nuance out of any of these conversations because it's almost like it's the settled law of the land how things work, and it takes the wind out of your lungs a little bit. To that point, let's get into some actual information because that's where I don't know. I can have my opinion about things, but the data is the data. So this was this is all kind of recent headline stuff. So this was a cool article from Kotaku talking about how 60% of playtime in 2023 went to 6-year-old or older games. And there's graphs by platform with, a lot of familiar faces in there. Fortnite, Roblox, Grand Theft Auto 5, Call of Duty. And then that's kind of four different Call of Duty games bundled under one thing.
Yeah,
it's got its own universe going on. FIFA, Apex Legends, Fall Guys, Valorant, League of Legends. The service games have taken over people's playtime, which is not shocking. That's what they were designed to do. So that's where all the time is going, which is aggravating when you want to think about a new, air quotes, new game like Dragon's Dogma 2, new IP.
Right.
New AAA productions.
We should mention that a lot of these, or about half of them, are free-to-plays. So they are free to play as much as you want, but that's when they get you, right? They hook you with the gameplay, and then you're buying cosmetics, you're buying, all sorts of other random stuff in these games. And but that's exactly what they're designed to do. And I will address the free-to-play stuff later on in the podcast. But just so you know, you could play these games for free for thousands of hours and never spend a dime.
That's true. And the dynamics there are also kind of they're kind of complicated on both the consumer side of things and also the industry side of things.
That's right.
I don't know. It's tough to complain about the state of anything when Genshin Impact is there and free, but also makes a ton of money of people rolling the dice on their animes. So It feels icky, but also it ostensibly is a good thing. Speaking of good things, physical, well, speaking of interesting things, I should say, physical's gone. Baby, is it gone?
Oh, yeah. So that's long gone.
I was trying to look up some general information about the way people spend money in games, just to kind of get a handle on it, and to see if it's a tide that's capable of being pushed back. I did find physical, there's like a handy chart provided by MPD Group and Sensor Tower, MPD Group and other, I think it's just MPD Group, actually. The problem is, physical sales are so tiny compared to the spending in gaming. 5% is the amount of physical spend versus digital in gaming in 2023. Uh-huh. And that's down from 10% in 2019. So it's minuscule, and it is dropping real fast. Yeah. That can loosely be linked to Sony's financial statements, because Sony is one of the only companies that breaks down their revenue by type. Gotcha. Their revenue is 94% digital, and that's actually pretty close to the industry at large. So I think some of the way that their income breaks down can be probably extrapolated to how games earn money in general. And this is another headline that made the round, so it's probably not a shock to people that follow the news. Add-on content is not only significant, it is the majority of their digital revenue.
That's crazy. The majority. I mean, like, really think about that. That's very important that the add-on content is the majority of the revenue. That's why you see it in every video game.
It's more than the cost of the games themselves, digital and physical combined.
Man.
It ranges from 50 to 69% nice of their games revenue by quarter. So at worst, it's half. It's a combination of factors then. Not only is digital the vast majority of all spending in gaming, but add-on content is the easy majority of all of that spending, extrapolated from PlayStation's revenue. But again, we don't get broken down data from a lot of other companies. So that hurts. That's an oof, but it's there, right? That's how people are spending money. That's it. That's the data, at least under the PlayStation umbrella, but that's a very large sample size.
And Lawrence, you put in an article from PR Newswire about how much total video game sales were in 2023. Mm-hmm. And I thought it's just interesting to hear these numbers. Gives you context more so than it really supports a point in a podcast, but it made $57.2 billion total video game sales in 2023, which is up from $56.6 billion in 2022. So only increased a little bit. And it's driven by a 13% increase in digital download spending across console platforms, of course, and an 11% increase in digital premium download segments on PC, cloud, and then non-console VR platforms. So hardware sales were only $6.6 billion, which is a very small percentage of that $57 billion. And then the accessory sales were around like $2.6 billion. So interesting to note, hardware and accessories are a very, very small percentage of actual total video game sales. There's another interesting part of this table that it's on this PR Newswire article, and it shows top grossing for console and PC, and then for mobile. And Lawrence, I could not find how much each one of those made. Could you find that anywhere in this article? How much, like, for example, Hogwarts Legacy was number one in 2023, but we don't know how much Hogwarts Legacy made of that chunk. Did you see that?
No, anywhere? But I should warn you about that graph. So at the bottom, it says digital sales not included.
Oh my
gosh. Yeah, that's the thing about that chart, is that it's interesting to think about. And to some degree, it's kind of heartening, because there are like not uncomplicated. Well, no, wait, Hogwarts had some monetization bullshit going on with it, I thought. Anyway, there are some savior games in there, like Spider-Man 2, I guess, Jedi Survivor. But it's also, what, 5% of the market is represented by that graph, which is physical right. game spend.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of tough. And you're right. It's like companies don't say out loud how much money they make on an individual game unless they're bragging. And when they do that, they certainly don't break it down based on the amount of money they got from game sales versus selling skins or microtransactions or what have you.
So this is one thing I want, because I I noticed, I've been reading about Monopoly Go. And Monopoly Go is on that chart. It's a section of revenue in 2023 of the $57 billion. Mm-hmm. And I was like, huh, interesting, because Monopoly Go obviously is a mobile game. It's a free-to-play mobile game, I believe. And it doesn't show how much it made. If you Google it, Hasbro actually did a little release about how much Monopoly Go made. Monopoly Go made $2 billion in revenue in 10 months. In 10 months.
Wait a minute. That means Monopoly Go is a significant portion of the entire games industry's revenue.
I mean, we can hold on. We can do the math. Yeah. It's $2 billion, right?
Yeah, and it was like 50, how much? 57
point. Yeah, 57 point. So if you just
3.5%.
There you go. Yeah. So
of all of gaming is Monopoly Go.
And that's only in 10 months. So I remember reading this and being like, because I hadn't even really thought about Monopoly Go.
I had to admit, I was like, where's Bruce going with this? But that a single mobile app is 3.5% of all of gaming kind of hurts my ribs a little bit. I don't know why.
I knew it would. That's why I brought it up. Because this was a game I was barely even aware of. And which is it again, this, I think we're kind of going down this line of thinking right now in this podcast, which is enthusiast gaming, us and the people that watch our videos and comments, all that other stuff, is the maybe, you know, a 10-15% of gaming at large. And that's important to note. I'm just throwing numbers out, obviously, but we are a smaller portion of gaming at large across the world. And Monopoly Go is the best example of this.
Did Monopoly Go made more money than Elden Ring, right? Hold on.
Well, I made $2 billion in 10 months, so I don't know what...
23 million copies. Hold on a second. No, there's no way, dude. Hold on. 60 bucks each. Uh-huh. Well, that's like... Yeah, that's like $1.3 billion in just raw revenue.
Okay. All right.
23 million. If they're all sold at $60, that's like $1.3 billion, right? Right? Yeah.
I can do the math if you want. I can just actually do the raw numbers. You said 23 million copies, right?
Yeah. So
times 60. Yeah, 1.4 billion. 1.4. So, and that's since its release in what, 2021? 2022? 2022?
Yeah, that's not in 10 months, is it? Oh my god, and the effort required to make Elden Ring versus Monopoly Go. I mean, I shouldn't trivialize mobile game design, because there is a very black art in doing just the right amount of sparkles and happy sounds and buttons that are fun to tap on. Like, that's some deep monkey brain stuff. I think it's pretty similar to like slot machines and stuff I see.
Oh, it totally is. Yeah, absolutely.
Which is creepy in its own right. But still, we're all adults spending our money in the ways we want, and that's how things shake out. So,
well, I wanted to bring that up because it was a great article you included in the Google doc. But I knew that Monopoly Go made a lot of money. I just didn't know how much and what the percentage was, and it is shocking. Mm-hmm. And sobering. And it reminds me, because I constantly, that's one of the things we aim to do on this show, this podcast and our news, is remind you that there is a larger gaming world that never come onto YouTube and make comments or never go on a subreddit and complain. They just go and spend money. And Monopoly Go is the best, is a very good example of that.
Yeah. That's a great point, Bruce. And the thing is, from our side, the distinction seems obvious. You know, we buy games and play them for different reasons and spend money in different ways than a mobile consumer might. But to a business person, holy cow, they like, there's no line at all. And why would you ever make an Elden Ring when you could seed like 10 Monopoly Goes? And if one of them hits half as well, you already ahead of the game. Yeah. Right. So I think that also can factor in a little bit when it comes to maybe sometimes how games companies communicate with their fan base or maybe I think in the case of like Dragon's Dogma 2, something that from their perspective probably seems like one of the least predatory things in the world, but just landed in the middle of a lot of grumpy gamers. That kind of gets to what I tend to do, which is, I guess, understand where this stuff is coming from or try to understand the trends around it. One thing that one thing that bums me is when people kind of take their eye off the ball a little bit, I guess.
Okay. All right.
To me, there's a lot of context that Dragon's Dogma 2 is the exact kind of game we need to protect, because it's going to, I feel like it's the kind of game that's going to get much more rare in the coming years. And it's a shame to like eat it now, just for fun, because a lot of games publishers are talking about how they're going to really kind of scale back their AAA stuff.
Yeah.
But to the point of like getting more money out of people and the annoyance that that comes with, and how that might result in like lashing out at some random shit that's just extra annoying. The early access stuff. I think this is the ground that should be preserved here, because this is what's being lost right now. Developers are getting crafty. They're finding ways to rebrand or actually increase the sticker price of a game. And one of the more clever ones, I think, is this early access concept. Mm-hmm. And Star Wars Outlaws. So kind of linking it to something that's happening right now. Star Wars Outlaws announced their gold and extra ultimate edition for $110 US, $130 respectively. For gold, you get 3 days of early access, ship and speeder cosmetics, and the season pass, which are two DLCs, but no more information is known about them right now. So, and $110 over $70, which is what I'll assume for the base game.
Yeah, yeah.
That is a 56% increase. That's like over half cost up just to play it 3 days early. That's the only thing you get right off the bat, by the way. I guess you get skins. You get skins, you get to play it 3 days early, and you get some DLC that they don't even feel like they have to sell you on, which is, to me, is absurd. They don't have to tell you what's going to be in them or promise any kind of content scope. So you're buying air in 3 days time for $40. That's a lot. Like that, the margin on that is absurd compared to what the base game is supposed to have. And that's kind of the thing about skins and microtransactions, is that the return on investment is so absurdly high compared to everything else. So yeah, that's what angers me. And I guess free market principles mean they can do whatever they want to do, but that's where it's working. And if this is working, they're going to keep biting until somebody says that's too much. I'm sure they're doing focus testing and stuff to figure out what the perceptive limit is. But this stuff scares me, because I think about like GTA 5, and I brought this hypothetical up before, but they could, if they charged for a week early access,
oh my gosh,
or a month early access, they would have people's bank accounts.
You meant to say GTA 6, but yeah.
I'm sorry. Six. Yeah. So also, I have to admit, this is something that also strikes close to home, because this is there's a bit of streamer tax here, Bruce. If a big game comes out, we kind of obligated to get in there early. Now, I'm not going to shed a whole lot of tears for a tax deductible purchase, which that then becomes. So whatever, man, you know, playing video games all day isn't the worst thing in the world, but it does make me feel compelled in a way that I think helps me empathize with members of the audience that feel unfairly manipulated, I think.
Well, Starfield, I think, charged, was it $30, I believe, for early access?
Well, the game was 70.
On top of the 70, right? Was it 100?
I thought it was 20 for early access, because the like...
Oh, was it 20? That's not too bad. Hilariously, it's not too bad compared to this Ubisoft tax. And I believe it was maybe 5 days of early access for Starfield. Now, if you think of it this way, too, this is another thing that I can almost guarantee, Lawrence. If somebody pays $110... for the 3 days of early access, this motherfucking game is not going to work. And this is something that really bugs me about this.
If it's broken, your 3 days evaporate. You get no value out of it. Yeah.
Now, what they'll probably do, because this has happened before, is they'll refund you or send you an extra, whatever, $10 in Ubi currency or whatever the fuck, if the game doesn't work. But they got your money. And that, I think, is maybe the biggest risk for people that are paying for early access, is that the fact that the game won't run. So I could be wrong, by the way. The game could run, but I doubt it. Like, I'm not betting on it. And you can, you know, like, Lawrence and I are going to be there day one, I'm sure, of early access, right? Because we have to. It's our job.
It does look pretty good. It looks like a pretty good game.
Oh, I can't wait. I'm very excited to play Star Wars Outlaws, by the way. I'm super excited about this, but they're raising the price of this early access window, or I'm sorry, lowering the early access window from 5 days like Starfield to 3, and then raising the price. So this feels like shrinkflation for an early access period. And like Lauren said, they're just going to keep testing. They're going to keep pushing at that electric fence until finally that no one wants to do it. And they go, all right, never mind. And this is yet another time that I'm like, guys, don't do it. Don't spend $40 or hell, what is that? Almost $60 for the Ultimate Edition. And for 3 days of early access, don't do it. Just wait a few days. Pay $70. Holy hell. Because I can already see the forum posts and the comments about how people are going to be so angry that this game doesn't work when they paid almost double retail. So,
yeah, that would be terrible. Holy cow. you'd want to tell yourself, if they're accepting even more money from customers, that they would be extra careful that it's going to work. And maybe first couple of times, because they have to legitimize the practice, right? But once it becomes the new normal, that's kind of what I'm waiting for, is the way that I look at it now is that it's launching at 110, and then 3 days later, it's going to discount to $70. I feel like at some point, yeah, they're going to play with the price difference. They're going to play with that gap of time. And then the launch will just commonly shift back with a sale announced for the near future. What bugs me the most about this stuff, there's the like 50-50 shot that the game will be playable and enjoyable and properly optimized and work in the first 3 days. But what bugs me even more than that, really, is the concept that they're asking you to pay for two DLCs that they don't define it all.
Yeah.
It really bugs me that they can sell you something and then decide after the fact that they're going to make it smaller, or that the DLC will just grow to fill whatever space that they sold through at. Or they can take in all the money and then decide exactly what their ROI needs to be and invest only that much time and then ship it. Sure. So it's kind of like weirdly crowdfund. It feels like you're crowdfunding DLC.
Yeah. You are. That's what you're doing.
But that's so galling. Crowdfunding DLC is me buying the game in the first place, I would think. Well, I guess that's whatever. I guess I'm exchanging it for the assets and the effort made to make it. But who would ever do that without even playing the game in the first place to know that you like it? What occurred to me, there was this comment from a million years ago. I think Cliffy B commented about Gears of War. And the reason they never did demos for Gears of War is because he commented how, like, they found in focus tests that players, there was momentum behind anticipation. People wanted to spend more on the game before they played it. But the second they touched it, part of the mystery was ruined. Part of the hype was made real. I think with this early access thing, and especially with selling DLC before it even exists, they're definitely harnessing the fact that purchasing intent is highest before somebody's even set foot in a game. If you deconstruct that means that human beings actually like the titillation and anticipation. They're willing to pay for that more than they are actually sitting down and playing something, which kind of makes sense when you consider that people argue on Reddit all day instead of just playing video games and being happy.
Well, Lawrence, I mean, it's interesting that you say that. I'm surprised you didn't know that, because that's something I've known for so long. Because as soon as it actually gets into your... I mean, like, the No Man's Sky is my perfect example of this, where... people talked about how No Man's Sky, you know, obviously, what's his name? Sean Murray came out and was like, it can do everything. It does everything, all of it, right? And everyone's like, this is going to be the greatest video. It's not going to be a video game. This is going to be an experience. This is going to be my life. This is going to be, because they had never touched it. Mm. And both you and I, obviously, having played video games for 30 years or whatever, we're both like, it's a video game. It's going to be a video game. There's going to be a gameplay loop. Like, we knew what there was. But if you talk about it enough, then eventually people are like, this is it. It's going to cure all my diseases, and I'm going to be rich, and like, it's everything to everyone. But then as soon as you get it physically in your hands, you go, oh, it's a game. And that's a perfect example for Cliffy B too, which is, he discovered that, but that's true. I mean, that's the way so few things in art, commercial art, especially like movies or television, actually are transcendent. Are the things that actually you watch or play and go, I'll remember this for the rest of my life. That doesn't happen very often. And it's very rare, but they have to sell that experience before anybody ever does it. And I don't like that. I don't like that at all. So,
Man, that's the problem is, I think now that we've kind of reinvented, I guess, a few wheels of marketing, or at least I have in my own brain, it kind of has arrived where everything else does, which is that marketing builds up an anticipation in your head, and you as an educated shopper need to be wise to that.
But there are a lot of people that are not. Mm-hmm. So, and actually, another good example is Cyberpunk too. Cyberpunk is exactly the same. Like, everyone was being let down. It wasn't this. It wasn't that. And like, I was like, but it's a video game. It's always been a video game. Like, I'm going to see T poses. That's just part of it. So I don't know. It's just not everybody has experienced it yet. So there's going to be a whole new generation of people being let down by GTA 6 or something, you know?
So. Yeah, I wonder if it'll get to a point where that hysteria is like kids that just fundamentally grow up with games and games that can do pretty amazing things. I wonder if those boundaries will just be more normalized at some point about what the kind of experience a game will or won't be allowed to offer.
I don't know.
I think at this point, well, I guess there's a, you know, there's a sucker born every minute. So you're right. There's probably going to be this like stripe, this age range of like maybe 17 to 21. It gets really suckered by the one game that just becomes their personality for a little bit. But I guess that happens with a lot of things. I remember like really following certain bands and being like, this next album is going to be the shit. And then it's just like a completely different thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess it's just all part of the cycle. I'm trying to bring it back, I guess, to the current hand-wringing over, I guess, the state of monetization in games. And I guess from, well, let's see here. What have we learned so far? We learned that mobile games earn a lot of money, but I guess we kind of already knew that. We've learned that add-on spending is the majority of all digital revenue, which is scary. And that's even in the sub-bubble of like enthusiast console gaming, or at least within the PlayStation umbrella.
We learned physical media is basically gone at this point. It's all digital.
Mm-hmm. Games publishers are coming up with new ways to cognitively raise the price of a game, or at least they're finding ways to monetize very high margin things like time.
Yeah.
So they're really finding ways to squeeze the angles, which apparently they have to do, because there's also been some headlines like this of recent releases that do not do nearly enough business to justify their existence. One of the saddest ones recently was the Dead Space remake. A remake made in perfect faith. The best possible kind of project that somebody that laments EA and where they've gone could hope for, right? Single player experience, no monetization bullshit, all made in the spirit of the original game. But apparently, what is it? Missed internal targets.
For the first Dead Space remake.
Yeah.
And that's why they canceled the Dead Space 2 remake. Is that right?
Yeah, this story kind of bounced around. Jeff Grubb originally reported some details of it. EA was like, that is untrue. And then Schreier was like, well, sort of, but it happened earlier for different reasons, but it's still the same result, is that, Dead Space Remake didn't sell. They were hoping that Dead Space Remake would sell and lead to an original game. One step down from that, apparently, was a Dead Space 2 remake, but they didn't even hit the targets for that.
Oh.
So, well, every time I bring this up, sorry.
Go ahead.
Whenever I bring up the games that don't work, people always point out one completely unrelated thing as the reason that didn't count. But the reason I bring up Dead Space Remake is I don't think anyone can stick anything to it apart from maybe some generic thing about like, oh, EA didn't release it at the right time or didn't market it enough is always the one.
I completely disagree. I honestly thought Dead Space Remake, because I did a 24-hour stream on it. Not only did I do a 24-hour stream on it, I played it through 3 times in those 24 hours. It was fucking awesome. Almost a perfect video game, single-player wise. And I'd played the original Dead Space. And it released in like January. So it was like nothing else was around it. There was nothing selling against it. I thought, honestly, they had a hit on their hands. I was like, wow, this is, in my opinion, this is like the perfect video game. It's really short, super enjoyable. I feel like it appealed to a pretty large audience. And I'm super bummed to hear it didn't hit its targets.
Me too. A couple of other games that similarly slipped, but I think like people shrug it off easier for some reason. Mortals of Avium, Callisto Protocol. These were pretty high spec, high scope, single player games that, well, I think Callisto Protocol had some additional content, but ostensibly it was that kind of game from the golden years of the aughts, a big budget single player thing with lots of cutscenes and cool combos and stuff. The market just didn't show up for it. I don't bring that stuff up to try to shame people out of their opinions, because I don't want it to sound like that. It's like, oh, you guys didn't show up and spend enough money, and that's why you're in this situation. No. Yeah. It is unfortunately confronting the reality of the market. That's right. So when a game like that launches and it has some extended monetization, maybe there's a reason. Greed won, of course. Companies always want to, but we want to tell ourselves that the exact kind of products we want will succeed as long as they make it to market untinged by greed. But there's a lot of evidence that that's not always the case either.
Well, I mean, people are going to say, I mean, like an original IP single player experience, like Immortals of Avium, that is, I mean, like that's got three strikes against it before it even hits the market. And I played it. It was enjoyable. It wasn't like, you know, transcendent or it was cool. But I was like, boy, there's no way anybody's paying $60 or $70 for this. No way. Callisto Protocol, if I recall, had a day and a half of people complaining about stutters.
It did stutter. That's true. It was stuttery.
They actually patched that within like 24 hours. They had fixed that within 24 hours. I remember that because I was like, wow, they fixed it right away. It didn't matter. Everyone talked about how bad it was and blah, 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 blah. And it was great. I played through it and really enjoyed it. So to me, like those sorts of games, like apart from one just kind of randomly going viral and like all of a sudden being the thing that everybody plays, which kind of doesn't really happen to these games. It'll happen to the Lethal Companies, but it won't happen to these sorts of games because these are big budgets and everyone knows they are. I just don't think they stand a chance. Like the only other game I can think of, and unfortunately it's a remake, is Resident Evil 4, right? Resident Evil 4 remake, I think, sold well, and it was a fantastic video game. So I would assume they're going to continue remaking other Resident Evils, which, in my opinion, I kind of don't want. I don't want more remakes. I would love to see more original games that are like that. I would love to see that team work on something new. Versus like, okay, well now I get Resident Evil 5 remake, then I get Resident Evil 6 remake. Like, I don't want those.
A Resident Evil 6 remake would be dope though. Maybe if they made it not play like shit, but how do you remake something like 6? How do you even do that?
That's what I mean. Is that like, it's no, I'm not saying I'm not going to play it, but, but for me, I like seeing new stuff. Huh. Because that's generally when you start to feel things from art, is when you see new things. Mm-hmm. It's not when you see the 30th MCU movie, right? It's when you go like, oh my gosh, this blew my mind. It was, Monkey Man or something. I haven't seen it, but that sort of thing. That's like not so derivative. And that's why it's such a bummer to hear that Immortals of Avium or Callisto Protocol didn't succeed and actually were pretty major failures.
Yep, it's going to make everyone scatter away from things like that. So it's, yeah, it's it is the way of things.
It is, yeah.
I guess we can, at this point, try to turn it into, all right, where do we go from here? if that's where we're at. I'm trying to think how to phrase this. There's people on the internet that are just, like, venting. Just like, this sucks. And it does. Exactly where it ought to be. In the case of Dragon's Dogma 2 or something, you get in there and you're like, man, these fucking guys always trying to get you. All right. You know what? Inbounds, totally fair. But beyond that, I don't know. I don't think it's unreasonable. Well, I don't think it's necessarily unreasonable to... Maybe I should ask you, Bruce. Is it unreasonable to ask somebody to be a little chill about it because of the difficulty it is for these products to turn a profit? I guess it doesn't feel like that when you're putting down $70 for a goddamn game and it feels like it runs bad.
Yeah, I mean, yes. So there are, I think there are some cases where it's totally fine to get on and write a, you know, one sentence, dude, this sucks type thing, right? However, there's a line, in my opinion. And the reason I say this is because Lawrence and I live on the internet, and we have for years. There's a very, very thin line between, oh man, what a bummer, this sucks, like, I'm going to get a refund or whatever, which, by the way, you should do. If you buy a game and it sucks, get a refund. First thing, don't go to Reddit. Get a refund first. Then you can go to Reddit. But if you start writing manifestos, start writing 2, 3, 4, 5 paragraph, 10 page, why Dragon's Dogma, you know, killed your wife and all that other stuff. Like, what you're doing is you're frothing the internet for no good reason at all. I don't think you're helping anyone. I think you're making everyone around you also upset, and you know, you're all frothing together, right? Which feels good. I get it. But then also there's a bunch of other developers that see all this and go and are getting, and like, it starts turning into personal attacks. Then we start getting really into like dangerous territory. So I think it's cool to go on and be like, man, this sucks. And then somebody else goes, yeah, this sucks. And you're like, yeah, ah, that sucks. You know? And then it ends right there. But then if you're like, so you start doing investigative journalism, right? You're like, okay, well, I got to figure out why the Dragon's Dogma did these microtransactions. And then you like get on, you're like, yeah, this one person did this, and I saw this one developer do this. And it's, and then it turns into attacks. It just does. And then it helps nobody. So, and then developers shut down the conversation with their fans because they don't want to deal with that. So it's just be aware of what you're typing. I know it feels like you're anonymous, who gives a shit, right? But just be aware of the language you're putting out into the world.
Yeah, I obviously agree. Also spending a lot of time on the internet. I guess the message that I would spend for people that stress about the state of those things is to be more skeptical of what seems like the consensus of the internet is. Because it's kind of become its own thing, the zeitgeist of the internet, or the geist of the internet, whatever. I've started to notice this pattern, and I bring it up a lot on Inside Games, but the like outrage culture, such as it is within games, is kind of a self-sustaining machine. Bruce, like you said, there are people who just go and froth, and it feels good, I think, because they enjoy the solidarity of it, and it feels good to have an enemy. It feels bad to me when that beam gets pointed at our friends at Capcom, I think, because yeah. I've really enjoyed their output, so that's a personal thing, but yeah. It's the rage bait, the misrepresentation. I really hope that you know, some of the more reasonable minds kind of saw the weird discourse around Dragon's Dogma 2 and decided that, man, people get really twisted up over things that aren't that big of a deal, and in some cases even actively misrepresent it for the sake of frothing. So yeah, I hope that there's just more of an air of skepticism about angry gamer consensus. And more of a culture of just like curious investigation on an individual level. And I think there still is a lot of that too. I mean, I hate to keep throwing it back to this, but Dragon's Dogma 2 did kind of bring up the whole microtransaction issue. Did have a lot of people filtering into streams, just checking it out. Being like, how is it?
They did, yeah.
Seems
yeah.
fine. I don't see like a lot of pop-ups or DLC bait or anything like that. So yeah, use your own two eyes. Like Bruce, like you said, buy from a store that has a return policy, like know your rights as a consumer, buy in a way where your money is protected. What bugs me about Star Wars is it's going to get sold through Ubisoft. They're not selling it through Steam. Man. Yeah, they want that. They want all that pie to themselves. And in some ways, that dynamic's kind of interesting too, because Ubisoft's got to make their Star Wars licensing money back.
Right.
And I wonder which is worse. Actually, so this is a complete swerve, Bruce, but I'm curious what you think. What's the better monetization? I should say, like, more pure monetization. So EA was under the Star Wars anvil, and they decided to make Battlefront, selling star cards and shit. They tried basically put, like, FIFA Ultimate Team into Battlefront, because it worked for FIFA. Why wouldn't it print money with Star Wars? That sucked. But it was ostensibly, like, an unending fountain of money for EA if Battlefront got off the ground as a property. Or you have Star Wars Outlaws, which is charging you $110 for 3 days of access
and
non-existing DLC. Would you rather pay for generic content up front or play a service game that's a little more geared around pushing you towards purchases a little bit all the time?
Well, Lawrence, I don't want to pick either one of these.
I don't either.
And I'll give you the reason why. Because Battlefront was pay to win when it started. So if, for example, if Battlefront had been pay for cosmetics, but not pay to win, I would say Battlefront 10 times out of 10. I would much rather have a Helldivers scenario, which is you enjoy the video game, you go and play it, and you can also buy some fun skins for Darth Vader. Like, and I'd be like, cool. Yeah. That's fine with me because they made a fun game. But the Battlefront monetary scenario was all pay to win for those stupid fucking cards. And I think in this case, if I have to take both at face value, I go the Ubisoft route. I would rather pay, because by the way, I have the choice to choose the early access. I can be like, fuck it, I'll just wait 3 days, you know, like, and then pay 70. I would rather that than the pay to win scenario. Oh, the worst possible way to do MTX. The worst.
I agree. So. Yeah, they really tried to hide it in Battlefront 2 as well. It was so confusing. I could see the gears turning. I feel like Diablo Immortal felt the same way. It's like, wow, you guys invented all these hoops and like mirrors and smoke and stuff to try to mask the fact that it is, you know, pay to win.
Yeah.
But I guess that's become more normalized, and now it's just kind of on the player to understand what game they're getting into, something like Call of Duty or something like that.
Yeah,
I agree, Bruce, also on the monetization aspect, the Ubisoft thing. I feel like once you're through the door, then you should be in the clear, right? Because then it's just a single player open world game. Unless there's going to be a store tab in the game.
Of course there are. Yes,
you're going to have to open the menu all the time, and there's always going to be that little thing up there with a stupid red dot right on there.
Yeah, you got the little dot. Yeah, absolutely. But
speaking of the little red dot, there is a lawsuit, and Bruce, you actually sent this to me, which I have been waiting for. I've been waiting for something to turn legal when it comes to the monetization of games. So this is from an article on PC Gamer from the end of March. A string of 6 video game addiction lawsuits have been recently filed against Microsoft, Activision, Blizzard, Roblox, Epic Games, Rockstar, and other major game developers and publishers. The complaints, which were all submitted to courts within the past 12 months, claim that game developers are intentionally making players addicted to their games. You know, this is about dark patterns and like patterns within the game that funnel you to purchases and manipulate you to buying things. I mean, it's scary stuff, really, and creepy, fundamentally creepy to hear how it's actually designed and the way that people architect it to rewrite your brain into buying things. But that's always been advertising, right? We just have to collectively decide when it's too creepy and too far. But the response was, and this is great, the general response is that they can't be sued for making games too entertaining.
That's right, yeah.
And then where do you draw the line between somebody being entertained and somebody being manipulated or held hostage?
Is that up to the courts? Is that up to the judge? Is that up to a jury? I mean, like, do we really? I think you wrote in there, it'll never go to trial.
No.
Ever. Because
at best, they'll get a settlement, and that's the only reason that this suit is happening.
That's right. Yeah, that's why they're doing it. But it's funny to see. Somebody suing the movie industry and being like, they made this movie too good. You know, like, In a lot of cases with movies, at least you can get a refund or something. Not always, but most of the time. But imagine, like, you know, you saw a bad movie and you walk out and you go, well, I saw a bad movie. I don't necessarily know. I think my movie analogy falls apart because games are so much longer. There's so much more long tail to them. You play them for hundreds of hours, and I think that's when they become more addictive. So I'm trying to think of other things other than gambling, by the way. That's like the only other analogy, right?
Gambling is the closest one, which is also kind of icky and should say gross. More than it does, really.
Yeah, yeah. So there are two extremes to that analogy that I really can't find the middle of. But I mean, I we've said forever and ever, loot boxes are getting banned in a lot of different countries because they are gambling. That's what they are. So I'm fine with that. I'm fine with loot boxes getting banned. That doesn't bother me at all. So the two entertaining thing now, again, Fortnite's free. It's like you could go on and play again. You could, if you have any ounce of willpower, you could play this for hundreds of hours and never touch the microtransactions. I don't know. So,
I think the issue is priming children with that kind of thing, getting them used to certain
absolutely.
Things.
Yes.
And I mean, Epic even had to settle with I think the FTC over a bunch of racked up charges by kids inside Fortnite. So it's a real thing. What I enjoy about this particular example is that it's a very real example of what happens when you try to take real world action on this kind of issue. To me, this is the most direct way to make change on this, which is kind of getting into the next thing we'll talk about, is to sue, to change the law so that it is illegal to monetize video games like this.
That's true. You're right.
You can write to your senators that this is the society we've created. And if you want to fix and you want to like really move wheels in a very official manner, that's how to do it. But I think I don't want to get defeatist or speak negative into the world, but I don't know. Something tells me that kind of like this particular lawsuit, when you start to really think about changing the state of things, then it gets hard to find a convincing argument. It gets hard to say something that really sticks. And I think, Bruce, that was kind of where you're like, well, this is waffling between like entertainment, just for purchased entertainment, and gambling, but it's somewhere fuzzy in the middle. How do we even legally define that? How would you describe that to a jury so that a jury gets it and votes in a way that makes any sense? Like somebody who doesn't play any, like a librarian? Are you going to tell them about GTA Online and how it's taking poor people's, I don't know. So that's when I start to think like, oh, I'm almost getting to the right frame of mind about this whole thing.
I know.
It's a sad. Very small issue, I'll consider, but.
That's true. All right. So we're sorry that you made this, you listened to us for 45 minutes. Here's how you actually change things.
Fix it.
Here's how you fix it. Because I've seen a lot of comments. And I will attempt to answer these comments and tell you what to do. Because I've seen a lot of comments about microtransactions because we've been talking a lot about them in the last few months. Lots of comments I've seen on our episodes are, number one, isn't complaining in YouTube comments and Reddit threads doing something? Won't it make companies change if we complain hard enough? And I've seen, this is not me making shit up. This is what I've seen people write. And the answer is no. It won't change a thing. There are very few examples of this. Sonic the Hedgehog, the design of Sonic the Hedgehog is one I can think of. Star Wars Battlefront, the monetization of Star Wars Battlefront is another one I can think of. But it's very rare. So generally speaking, the money talks. That's what happens. That's how you affect change. So if you really think this is your only outlet, let's say you bought Star Wars Outlaws and you can't get a refund, the only thing you can do is what I would do, is organize a subreddit or a Steam group. Get your friends together, make a digital friend group, and start telling people to not buy the game, and here's why. And lay out your argument clearly, concisely, because I promise you, our power as human beings, and generally as the, you know, whatever, the working class, etc., it lies in organizing. It does not lie in complaining. I'll show you 100 examples of one dude at a steel mill being like, this fucking sucks. And if he decides, I'm going to form a union, I'm going to get together with the other 100 steel mill workers that all are also complaining about the same thing, and we decide, we go to the bosses and we say, we're leaving if you don't fix this. That's what a union is. And that's how you affect change. So we've been doing it for a long time now in the Industrial Revolution. And we need it. It's very, very important. And whenever I see unions getting up there, you know, obviously everybody, whatever, there's corruption, etc. But generally speaking, when someone's up there fighting for the working man, I'm all about it. Like, because we have the numbers. That's what we have. We have the numbers. So if you get 1,000 people together that are like, I'm not going to buy Star Wars Outlaws, and those 1,000 people tell another 1,000 people, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it starts to snowball. But also, there's a really funny image of that Call of Duty Steam group.
God, I love that thing.
The story of this Call of Duty Steam group was that they had decided they were going to boycott Call of Duty. Why were they boycotting it, Lawrence?
Because I think Modern Warfare 2 was removing dedicated servers. You couldn't like run your own Call of Duty server and have people connect to it.
That's right. So they formed this Steam group. They said, we're not buying Call of Duty because they don't have dedicated servers. And then the picture is of all the people in this boycott group all playing Call of Duty at the same time. Because nobody stuck to their guns. And this is what you have to do. You have to organize and then stick to your guns. You have to actually believe in your convictions. Oh, it's my favorite.
I agree. Unfortunately, my cynicism says that that's gonna flow a couple of ways. So it's funny because the power of groups and stuff is powerful and organization is powerful. The problem is it gets hijacked by nonsense.
It does.
Again, throwing back to Dragon's Dogma 2, people were able to throw shit at that game and have it stick, and they were able to ward people off of like buying it or having an interest in it for the flimsiest of reasons. And that's what bugs me, is that gaming culture does have that power, but mostly people just try to attack every target and they only go in on the ones where they can sink their teeth in. And there's no like morality or consistency to that level of organization. So that's an interesting demon kind of running around in people's subconscious to try and also form a cohesive movement. Is you're going to have to like shout over the noise of all the rage bait in gaming circles.
Absolutely. And it's very hard. I'm not saying this is easy. I'm not saying this is easy at all, but it is something that you can do. And like you said, you could write your senator or whatever about how Dragon's Dogma 2 has microtransactions. Yeah, I mean, you go for it.
Predatory spending in gaming. I think it's something that especially like in connection with kids and gambling, that's how you get senators start to perk up. So now that if you get 1,000 people to write into a particular senator, then maybe you'll get a response or you could get something going. That would be pretty cool to see.
That's all about organizing. That's that's what you do. Then you put together a group and then you're all taking action. Now that requires work. That's not you just venting on Reddit. And that's why I'm saying that this requires work. So I'm sorry, but that's how it goes. all right, Lawrence, here's another one that I've seen floating around the internet. Aren't developers programming their games to force us to buy things with microtransactions? What I mean by that is Dragon's Dogma 2 gives you less fairy stones in game because they know you may buy them with real money if they give you less in the game. And this is something that I have thought about and been like, I guess it is possible. So for me, I will assume that this is really what devs are doing. Let's assume this is true. We don't actually know, but let's assume. The first thing you can do is hold fast. Do not buy them. Okay? Don't do it. Wait for your fairy stones to come in your video game. Don't go out and spend $2 on them through the Capcom store. Don't do it. Because if this is really happening, I can promise you that they do have analytics on how these microtransactions are selling. I promise you. They will find out that nobody bought these. And they will change their dev cycle for the next game. They will. Because they were like, oof, nobody bought those fairy stones. Don't do that again. And if we get proof that developers are changing games to force microtransaction purchases more often, well, then we know, right? Then we get proof of that. We get some director talking about it. We know to boycott the hell out of that entire company. Never buy another one of their games. If they publish anything, don't buy any of that stuff. Like anything they've touched, you stay away from it. We don't have proof of that right now. And I tend to agree in some cases that developers are changing the way they make games in order to make people spend more money. I don't think that that's out of the question. So the only thing we can do is to not buy those microtransactions. It's like so obvious, but I don't know that people understand that. Because if you're like, fuck it, They're making us do it. Who gives a shit? I'm just going to give in and do it. Like, no, never do that. Oh my gosh. Then you're only encouraging, you're reinforcing what they already think they know about their audience.
So. Yeah, I agree. I think it's, thing is, it's not, when games are monetized that way, it's not exactly subtle. And when it is subtle, it's actually really scary. But no, a game like Dragon's Dogma 2, again, specifically, I get the concern about fairy stones because, again, this is the rage bait machine that actually like landed some good shots. You saw like the headline of the designer saying, we took fast travel out, we don't need it. And then buying fast travel as DLC. That tells the exact story you don't want to hear. And that's the fear here. Right. But the frustrating thing is, I don't know. It was a good parry. It was a good edit. But like where that stuff actually happens, where it happened the most egregiously was like old coin-op arcade games. And the tricks that they would use were pretty insidious. One of my favorites was like, oh yeah, linking back to the anticipation thing, Ed Boon was talking about how they would do this in Mortal Kombat. They made the coolest boss the second to last boss. Because people would quarter feed to see the last boss. They wouldn't quarter feed to beat the last boss. So if you're jammed on the second to last guy, you're going to pump in a ton of quarters thinking that the last guy is going to be amazing. And then it's just the shriveled old guy who morphs into the cast. But I mean, there's perceptive tricks like that. Gosh, I think about the Konami beat 'em ups where there'd be a boss that would just like flash red faster.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And by the end, it'd be strobing and you'd be like, oh, he's almost dead. And then, of course, you'd lose and you got to put in a quarter because he's like, he's flashing like crazy. He's got to be one hit away. So, but those are kind of obvious, you know, as a thinking adult, you can see that happen and be like, oh, you son of a bitch. Okay. And then you pay your money. But, you know, you might do that once, they gotcha, but it's like a carnival game. You get wise to it. You see those trends. You can trust yourself to make those decisions. I guess everyone's afraid of getting suckered. And I think, you know, it's going to happen once or twice. You're going to get bitten. It almost feels like people have that defensiveness. They got their hackles up like they're going to a car mechanic. And they resent everything as an attack on their wallets and their integrity.
I mean, I think they should. I actually think that is a good attitude to have. I don't mean like you get your hackles up so you go on Reddit and start insulting people. Mm. I mean, you got your hackles up so you start making smart decisions. Like, you start actually being like, okay, well, I think they're trying to take my money here, so I'm not going to give it to them. That's what I would do. I mean, it's not, again, this isn't me like being like, well, you should resent everybody and hate all the devs. Like, no, like they're trying to take your money just like everybody else is. So be careful of where you spend your money. That's all I'm saying. Yeah, that's fantastic points about arcades because arcades did that for years and everybody knew. But when I was, you know, whatever, 9 and my dad was behind me being like, oh yeah, like I know where they're doing this. Right. And then my dad's telling me this is why they did it. And I'm like, oh, because I didn't know when I was 9. All right. I have another one. This is another one that's a super valid point that I've seen very often. Aren't whales a real problem? Now, whales are people that are a small percentage of the actual gaming audience, but they spend shitloads of money on mobile games, on all sorts of other, and pretty much any microtransaction. That's what a whale is. Are they not the ones that are spending thousands of dollars on microtransactions and then they're ruining it for the rest of us because they're encouraging that company, right, to keep making that same gameplay loop because they're giving them thousands of dollars? I've looked a lot on data for this because I've seen this and it's a totally valid point. So I can't really find data on what the percentage of an audience is that is a whale. Because I doubt they'd ever publish this. Generally, what I can find is whales generate a ton of revenue and are a very small fraction of the total people playing. But usually I can only find data that goes along with free-to-play models. So we're talking about Monopoly Go or a Candy Crush or a Fortnite or something like that. So, as usual, hold fast. Don't buy. If you're playing Fortnite and you're like, but the whales, they're all spending thousands of dollars on Fortnite and that's why they keep making microtransactions. Okay, I hear you. Don't spend your money on the microtransactions of Fortnite. Don't do it. Because if you're worried that a small percentage of people spending lots of money on microtransactions will encourage this type of game development and monetization further, organize a group, get a group together, tell all your friends, these whales are fucking up Fortnite. They're fucking up Fortnite, and they're making it so that we have to, everything's a, you know, $2 charge. Get your group together. Don't play Fortnite anymore. And start telling everybody else, Fortnite's sustained by whales, and I don't want to be part of this game because it's sustained by whales. And then also, like Lawrence always says, start buying the games that don't have microtransactions. Oh my gosh, that's like number one. Spend $10 or $5 on a Vampire Survivors or a Lethal Company or something like that that never has a microtransaction, and you can play for hundreds of hours and enjoy it. And that will also force the industry to be like, like look over the other way and be like, well, wait a minute. There's a couple of examples of these games that are just single player fun games, like an Elden Ring that really doesn't have any microtransactions. And then it made $1 billion, made almost $2 billion. So maybe we can make games like that.
There's a lot of vibrance there, which is usually where my thoughts go. I think it's a tiny bit of ego death is kind of necessary. I think it's it's embracing that the games that you want or the kinds of games that you like aren't necessarily the biggest, and the audience that you're in is no longer the most biggest representative audience. You're not necessarily the juiciest target, but that's not a bad thing because the whales are. So fine.
That's right.
They'll get all the glitzy stuff.
Let them be the target.
Yeah. Let them get wined and dined. I mean, I think this is pretty cool. Just today, there was a showcase called the Triple I Initiative.
Yeah.
Which I watched, and there's more and more of these popping up. Just like a week or two ago, there was the Future Game Show Spring Showcase. Both of them had tons of, you know, AA, III, I guess, games that are the exact kind of product that the people who hate extensive purchases don't have. I mean, early access is there in droves, so that's a thing. But and that does require a little bit more thought and research, I guess, into a purchase. But no DLC, just an idea, a game concept, executed faithfully, delivered up front, no tricks, no early access windows, no selling DLC before it exists, just 15, 20 bucks, bang, here's the thing. But again, like I was saying before, part of the trade-off is you kind of have to accept that since there's not whales right next to you, you may not get the glitziest production values. You may not get the most luscious CG rendered cutscenes. It may have a tick back in the production department, but I don't know. This may be more of an old man concept, but to me, even the AA layer, the III layer nowadays, it's better than games were top of the heap 10 years ago.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So it's the rising tide, I think, has lifted everything. You can get games at the AA layer for 20, 30 bucks that are better than $60 games were a decade ago. Yes. And inflation has kind of even made that money go down in value. So there is a bright promised land. And I think this is where the trick is, though. It does require just a teeny bit more research, because you can't just hit the same well. You can't go back to the big brands over and over and be like, yeah, good gaming. No. that's where all the money's going to get squeezed out of now. So yeah, that's where I always go for. It's just like, just make your peace. It's like Mads Mikkelsen in Rogue One. It's a peaceful life being here playing my playing my lovely like AA games from Middle Europe.
Yeah, I mean, it's again the best examples, like some of the games that I played the most are just the $10 games on Steam, like the ones that I've had the most fun. I just think there's so many of them. Like, I always go and look on Steam every day. I got to look at the early access tab and just see like the supermarket simulators and the, you know, the Death Must Dies and the, there's just so many. That Deep Rock Galactic Survivor game is so good. It's so good. And it's $10.
Oh man.
Like, it's like so much fun. I mean, and again, like I've been raving about it. Lawrence and I both love this game, Helldivers. Like, the motherfucker's $40, dude. Helldivers is fucking awesome. Like, this is a AAA game that's $40. And I will happily give it more of my money because it's so good. And I think like Lawrence said, the future is bright for those sorts of games. And it's really exciting to see. So don't dwell on the anger. Instead, do something. Channel it into something that will hopefully affect change, or be the Mads Mikkelsen and live a peaceful life.
Yeah, that's my takeaway. It's easier for me to convince myself that it's not a big deal than to try to externalize it. So that's what I do. Buddhist about these things. And also, I don't know, just as a longtime gaming enthusiast, I have been blown away with the quality of games lately, with their relative values. I think there's a lot of competition out there. I think if you work the angles, you can get a lot of great games for pretty cheap. That said, $70 is still a lot of money. It's still a lot to ask. But we are talking about entertainment, so I kind of also support at the same time the ability of developers and publishers to charge what they want on the open market and just see if the market's going to tolerate it. I'd like to think that there's a world where, like, this is going to... Listener, you're going to laugh out loud at this, but I'd like to think there's a world where something like Immortals of Avium comes out and weirdos like me are enough into that kind of game that we're willing to pay over $60-$70 for that. Just because Shenmue 4, you know? I'd pay a lot of money for a Shenmue 4. Nobody else would, but it'd be nice if every market could be served according to the willingness that the willingness of that market to pay. And it does seem like there's a lot of conventional thinking when it comes to how game content is priced. That said, I'm never gonna tell somebody that they're wrong for being hawkish about game prices, because I reap the benefits if people are arguing and the prices come down.
That's true. One thing I will say, by the way, one hard fast rule that I've been having for myself, just as a coda to this whole thing, is if you want to follow what I do, any game that is a full retail game, $60, $70, if there are cosmetics or a battle pass or something inside that game, I absolutely refuse to never give it any more money. The last time I did this was Battlefield 2042. And I'm pretty much, I think that's it. I'm done. I'm never doing it again. Cause I, whatever, purchased the $90 Ultimate Edition garbage cause I love Battlefield, and it was all trash and I didn't want any of it. And so now anytime I'm like, nah, if it's $70, no, that's it. That's all you're getting. That's where I draw the line.
Yeah. Wean yourself off of the idea that you're getting a suboptimal experience when really all you're missing out on is two skins you wouldn't use anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Lawrence, at the very end of this, you said, we had a bunch of comments that we didn't even get to address. I love the comments that you picked. We should save this and do this again for another podcast.
Yeah, I was impressed. A lot of the people in the audience had very kind of eloquent takes on how they viewed microtransactions, where they thought the lines and the boundaries of good taste were, unsurprisingly, in a lot of different places for a lot of different people. So,
that's right. Yeah. And at the very end, you said, you were wrong about Doom Eternal had DLC.
It did. Yeah, it did have DLC. And I guess you could buy your way through previous content tracks that had like skins and icons and stuff. Okay. But I mean, that distinguishing point aside, I was still kind of hoping that, you know, because I very personally like the game too, I was kind of hoping there'd be more celebration for it, because after launch the developers were still adding skins and things to it, which I thought was cool, adding master levels and stuff for free. It's not significant content updates, but it, you know, any little bit I thought was pretty cool to keep iterating and adding. So and then CD Projekt has been, you know, adding free stuff to Cyberpunk the whole while, and I think they've finally clawed their way back to neutral to good territory with most folks. So yeah, that it's just kind of paired with that, like, you know, we should spend equal, if not more, effort complaining and grumping about the annoying things as we do celebrating the good things and trying to make sure that awareness of that gets out. And that I'm just all about making sure that the people who try to do good work in the right way get celebrated. I want to do my part to balance the scales a little bit.
That's Arrowhead Studios and Helldivers, man. That 100%. Game changes almost every single day. And they've been adding more and more things. They're adding new races, new stratagems, and obviously there's a new battle pass you can spend your not even money on, credits you earn in game. Like, it's awesome.
Agreed. All right, well, thanks everybody for watching the Gamescast. Hopefully you spent this Gamescast playing a game you enjoy instead of getting gassed up to be mad about one you don't. So That's your Insight Games challenge for this month. Let's play video games and have fun.
That's great.